Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Addiction Unlimited podcast, where you get to learn everything you want to know about addiction and recovery. I'm your host, Angela Pugh, co-founder of Kansas City Recovery, life coach, and recovering alcoholic. To learn more about me, you can listen to episode zero on your podcast app or find us on the web at addictionunlimited.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Addiction Unlimited podcast. I'm your host, Angela Pugh. Thank you for spending some time with me today and listening to the pod. You're going to love this episode. Today, I'm recording in Palm Springs, California, with the one and only world-renowned Ken Seeley and Eric McLaughlin. So let's take a minute and welcome Ken to the show. Thank you so much for doing this with me.
Hey, thank you.
So good to see you. Yeah.
Oh, my God. It's been how many years?
It's been... What did we decide, Eric? How many years?
6 years.
Like 6 years. Yeah. It's been a while.
Wow.
So we have a lot of catching up to do.
Yeah.
Which is perfect for a podcast.
Right?
So tell everybody a little bit about
you.
Yeah. We're going to turn it into a gossip show. That'll be more fun. I'll get way more listeners. Tell everybody a little bit about you and what you do and what all you do. I mean, obviously, I think people are very aware of intervention, mm-hmm. the television show. Yep. Obviously, you're an interventionist. But what are the other pieces?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that because so many people know me from doing interventions because I've been doing them for over 20 years. But then... God, when was it? 3 years ago, 4 years ago, we opened up the treatment center here in Palm Springs. And about a year and a half ago, we opened up a detox residential. So we have the whole continuum of care for God.
Yeah, all levels of service.
Yeah. And the most important, I think, that we love that what we do different than anybody else that I... There's only one other facility that does this in the country, mm-hmm. but we include the family to sit at the treatment team table.
Oh, nice.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, yeah, that's very cool. And so that's something I find as an interventionist too, though, where I feel like a lot of people kind of drop the ball.
Yes.
Because when somebody hires me for an intervention, like I kind of joke with the family. I'm like, you never actually get rid of me. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like there's never a point I'm not going to answer the phone.
Yes.
Because it's so important after the intervention and your person goes to treatment, that's just step one.
Yes.
You know what I mean? At that point, we have phone calls that we need to manage. We have boundaries that we need to reestablish. Like there's so many things that happen on the family side.
Yes.
And a lot of people aren't giving them proper support.
Yeah. So we love when an interventionist brings us a client to treatment because all of that is already established.
Right.
The boundaries, the consequences if they start to act out or if they want to leave AMA, you know, everything's already implemented when they come in through an intervention.
Right.
And we're seeing that people have a higher success rate because they were intervened on because now they know what their rock bottom is and they're very clear about it.
Sure.
Right? When you do an intervention.
And everybody's on the same page.
Yes.
That's such an important piece that everybody's on the same page. There's no wishy-washy back and forth. Like the line in the sand has to be very clear.
Very clear.
For an addicted person especially.
Okay.
We are not the easiest.
Sometimes we're not hearing what you're saying.
But you know, I love doing... For exactly that reason, too, I love doing the transport when I do an intervention. Mm-hmm. Because to me, I mean, really, the travel is usually the most fun part because you can kind of relax at that point. And I always say I'm typically the only other addicted person in the room.
Yeah.
So I am just as much that person's teammate as I am the family's teammate, right? I speak that language. We're good. But I love using that travel time.
Yeah.
To really break down some of the treatment barriers and some of their fears and let them know, like, listen, this is what it goes. This is what it looks like. This is how it works. Don't be freaked out by this. So when they walk in the door, they have a whole different mindset. And a lot of those fears are lessened at the very least.
Yeah. Love that. I love that. And when they come in, when you bring them in from the intervention, now the family knows how to stay strength, you know, stay with their consequences. But like you said, that's never over.
Right.
Hello.
Right.
You're going to have to keep calling the family. Remember you said you were going to do this. So once you do
I always tell, I'm like, listen, every time your person calls you from treatment, call me.
Yes.
Before you say anything.
Yeah.
Like, call me first. Let's troubleshoot it.
Exactly. And that's what I think is so important. And what our treatment center does is we help the family come together And we don't call it a family intervention,
yeah.
but we really do an intervention on every single client that comes in. So if they're already in treatment with us, we work with the family systems and we work with them to show them how they've been supporting the addiction and how to support recovery moving forward.
Right.
And we create a family contract. Everything that we would normally do in a traditional intervention,
yeah.
we do with that family. Because that family is going to tell us more about the client than the client's going to tell us in 90 days.
For sure.
Right?
Yeah. yeah.
When you do an intervention, don't they yeah. tell you everything?
They definitely want you to know everything.
Yeah. Yes.
And they try to. But that's something you have to make clear, too, before you ever go in that room is listen, we have to be clear. This is not therapy, right? We have one
yes.
goal.
No.
We are going for one thing,
yep.
and that's our focus. And we'll work everything else out later,
yes.
you know, in treatment.
And that one goal, I think, is really important, too. It used to be when I started doing interventions, the one goal was to get them into treatment. That was my one goal.
Right.
But now I realized because people are going to treatment for 90 days and coming home and relapsing.
Right.
And it wasn't because they didn't have good treatment.
Yeah.
It was because the families didn't keep their consequences front and center when they got right. out of treatment.
Right.
They said, oh, you did your job. You did so well. You look so much better. And boom. Then they're back to using.
Now, do you think families are like that a little bit? Do you think they get overcome with hope?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I always oh. feel like. They get so wrapped up in the hope that
yes.
this is going to be it, you know? And I'm
oh,
like,
thank God.
I'm like, that sounds great, but you have to understand this is a monster,
yep.
you know? Addiction is a monster. So it's not a one and done situation,
and then
typically.
How many years did it take to
right,
get there?
Right.
So you're going to go away for
right.
90 days and you're going to be cured and they're going to be so happy, the families?
I do like, I feel like there's more transparency now in that this is a long-term treatment process.
Yes.
And not necessarily long-term inpatient treatment,
no.
but that this process of recovery and getting it to stick is long-term.
Yep. Yeah.
And because I feel like as on the professional side, we kind of got a bad rap for a long time
mm-hmm.
because I think the general public felt very misled.
Yes.
You know, I feel like they thought we're going to come in and save the day with our
yes.
cape and do the intervention and send them to treatment and everybody's magically fixed.
Yeah.
And I mean, damn, I wish it worked that way in my own recovery.
Yeah.
That's just not realistic. You know, so I love that there's more transparency and more conversation about that so people have a better understanding of what they're signing up for.
Yes.
You know, and that it's not quick.
Yeah, and I think that that's such a slow-moving process. You know, we kind of instituted a kind of a tagline of be clear, it's a year. So trying to get people to focus not on an intervention, mm-hmm. not on 30 days of treatment, not on 90 days of treatment, but a year of comprehensive, well-supported accountability and a program of recovery for a year, whatever that program looks like.
Right.
If it's a Suboxone maintenance program, you should still have the support to be able to do that effectively. If it's a non-traditional smart recovery approach, that's
right.
great too.
Yeah.
Right.
But there needs to be that overarching sense that helps with the continuum of care because relapse is so prevalent in this disease, and just like it is with any other disease, you know, diabetes,
yeah.
people eat sugar all the time and they
right.
shouldn't. So we don't throw people to the wayside in diabetes because they've had a relapse.
Right.
And we have to do better to catch that earlier, identify potential signs of that. And you can't do that if you say, hey, it was great knowing you. Good luck after treatment.
Right.
You have to be proactive. You have to be family oriented and you have to be long-term oriented to be able to bring about that change.
Yeah, it has to be long-term. And I'm glad you mentioned some of the other lesser known programs too, like Smart Recovery, because mm-hmm. there is such an incredible shift in yeah. recovery right now too. And where relapse is far more dangerous with this opiate epidemic
mm-hmm.
right now because people are dying much more quickly.
Yep.
Now, in the beginning of all the attention that the opiates were getting, I was a little irritated because I'm a drunk, you
yep.
know? And I was like, listen,
yep.
my drug of choice has been killing people
mm-hmm.
for hundreds of years. And
at
alcohol
a
at a much higher rate. And it kills people in all these different ways, you know?
Yeah.
But But now, I mean, I get it because with the opiates, people are dying much more quickly.
Yeah.
So it's even more important that people understand, like, this is a long-term thing and there are many options. Like, we can do many different things, but the longer we keep somebody engaged in some sort of process, obviously the better their results are going to be, the better their odds are.
Yeah, we had this client that, you know, I love telling this story because, you know, he came in on Suboxone, right? And we used to have a zero tolerance. No, you can't come in on any medication. You know, we're, you know, zero tolerance. You can't have your meds and you could only come in, you know, if you're abstinent and you're sober. And we did that for years. But the reality was this guy needed to be on that.
Right.
The trauma that he experienced, he wasn't able to reach that trauma now.
Yeah.
So the Suboxone is keeping him stabilized. And he's doing that as a maintenance, what it's used to be, what it's meant to be used for. And as time goes on, as long as you keep him in recovery, like for that year, my hope is maybe a year and a half down the road, he'll be able to come off that and deal with the trauma.
Right.
But right now, he's not ready for that.
I love that you phrased it that way too, because I've never thought of it kind of in those terms, that there's going to be stuff that people are not in a place to dig that deep yet. I've never thought about it like that. And that makes much more sense to me. I am not necessarily a zero tolerance Suboxone person. I don't love it.
Either do I.
Because I do feel like it has a tendency to create its own dependence.
Yes.
Even if it's just mentally and emotionally.
Yes.
So I don't like long-term, but when you phrased it the way you just phrased it, like that makes sense to me. That makes perfect sense
and
to me.
It was a husband and wife, and the wife, you know, could probably come off it. She really dug deep and she did the work. So she's ready to, you know, go to that next level. But if we were to say, okay, she's ready, so you need to be ready.
Right.
He's going to relapse and they're going to be living in misery just because she made it into recovery and he still needs time.
Right.
I mean, then how would we, that's like shame on us as professionals working in the field. Like, you know, we're not going to give you your time.
Right.
You know,
right.
You got 3 months.
We need you to be on our time.
Yeah. Yeah. 3 months, your wife did it and now you need to do it.
Yeah.
But there's so much more that you could see he was doing amazing in groups and trying. He was at least trying.
Yeah.
But when it came down into it, he just couldn't dig that deep.
Yeah.
And so maybe within time of sitting in more group therapies and working more one-on-ones, he could get to that point where his wife is at.
Yeah.
And then maybe they could have that healthy relationship. So they're both doing extremely well. And I'm so, you know, and I was against it too. Like you, I was like, nobody... 3 months, that's all you need.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But in all reality, who knows what they're dealing with?
I just try to be open-minded.
Yes.
And I try to really understand that what makes sense for me and how recovery makes sense for me is not how it's going to make sense to everybody else.
Yes.
Because my circumstances and my details were very different too. You know what I mean? So I try not to dictate what is correct for somebody else.
Yep.
But I do, I see this all the time in my, I was telling you before we started recording, I have two men's sober living houses in Kansas City. And we really do sober living very differently.
Yes.
Especially for Kansas City, for my region of the country, right? There aren't a lot of resources.
Yeah.
So I open sober living with a very different approach that's very, very much community focused and family focused. Like I tell people, we are a recovering family. We
love
function
that.
As a family. We have family style dinner. Everybody's required to do service work. We do that as a family. And we are a recovering family. And that's what we do. And everybody is connected and they stay connected. They do all the extracurricular things together. And we have this incredible culture where people are coming in and they're having fun in their sobriety. And that was a piece that was super important to me too, because it is about building your life in sobriety.
Yeah.
It's not about just white knuckling it and hanging on for dear life and hoping you stay sober. Like, we're building a life that we can go enjoy, you know, as sober people. But I have people that will slip on some obscure things. Like, I've had to deal with kratom a couple of times in the house.
Yep.
And this is a weird one, right? Because you can go buy it at the store.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
it's not good. Like, I'm not saying it's good.
Yeah.
But I'm also not a sober living that at the first sign of a mistake, somebody is thrown out on the street. Because to me, that's a teaching moment.
Yeah, no,
if I have a person who is working every other piece of the program, right? Mm-hmm. And they're really, and they're trying, just like you were talking about.
Trying.
They're digging, they're doing the work, mm-hmm. they're showing up, they're present.
Yep.
They have that willingness. If I've got a kid like that, mm-hmm. I'm not throwing him out on the street.
Yes.
I just dealt with this the other day. And I was sitting in the living room with the kid literally for 2 hours. And we just had some good recovery, life, get your shit together kind of conversation, you know?
Perfect.
And I said, listen, this is how I see it. There's addict behavior and there's recovery behavior. Mm-hmm. I said, and you've got 1 foot over here in addict behavior. And what I need for you to do is go ahead and drag that other foot into the recovery behavior and commit to it, you know? But it was a teaching moment. It wasn't a punitive moment.
Well, I think the other part that you need to really dig with him is when people relapse, they don't relapse because they want to relapse. They relapse because there's something in their past, a traumatic experience that happened, and it came to a head. And the fastest way to deal with it is self-medicate.
Right.
So taking that opportunity and educate, and like you do, and saying, okay, you need to dig into therapy. You need to get some real serious help. Where was it? What was it that made? Because they're thinking it was nothing. You know, well, the dealer was there, and you hear it all the time.
Yeah.
You're driving on your way to a 12-step meeting, and all of a sudden you parked in front of the dealer's house.
Right, right.
It's on automatic pilot.
Yeah.
Because the trauma, you know, the PTSD or whatever it may be, triggered back into their brain.
Right.
The easiest way to do it, do I go to that AA meeting and listen to those people complain?
Where I'm going to be uncomfortable.
Yes.
I'm going to sit there and be anxious and uncomfortable the whole time.
It doesn't really work. You know, those people are sicker than I am. And they go, you know, that tape starts playing.
Yes.
Or do I go get my comfort over here? And so when I look at a relapse, that's what I see is happening.
So interestingly, we had to start at a whole other spot because he wasn't even aware that he did something, quote unquote, wrong. He didn't even have that awareness because you can go buy it at the store.
Yeah.
He's like, well, I just got it at the gas station. I didn't think it was that big of a deal.
Well, you could buy
marijuana
at the store, too.
Well, not in Kansas.
Not yet, anyway.
Alcohol. Are you a dry state?
No, definitely not. That would have helped if we were. It would have helped my personal story. But yeah, he didn't even have the awareness that he, and we had to talk through whether or not it was a relapse. And he was asking me, he's like, well, wait a minute. Are you saying I relapsed? And I go, I'm not saying anything.
Yeah.
I'm saying that is a fantastic conversation for you and your sponsor.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. And to hash that out and figure out what you think about that. But yeah, so we had to start even earlier in that conversation of the fact that it was incorrect.
Yes.
And then also breaking it down where we have a responsibility as addicted people to protect one another.
Yes.
And there and to protect the integrity of our home that we work really hard to maintain.
Yeah.
And I have sober living with a crazy, amazing success rate, average length of stay. Like my guys hang out a long time.
We've
only been open 2 years, and I have celebrated 1 year of sobriety with at least 6 people.
Wow.
Like, I mean, it's cool. It's very cool. And it's very important to me that it stays that way.
Yeah.
So having a little Kratom capsule in your pocket in the house is not going to go over well with me. You know, so, but it was also putting it in those terms. Like, dude, you got to understand, we have to protect each other.
Yes.
Nobody will love us and protect us the way we will.
Yeah.
And you've got to protect everybody else in this house too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, which again, he had never thought of it in those terms.
Yeah.
And which I love that though, because again, it was a teaching moment.
Yeah.
It wasn't a moment to kick him out. It was a moment to give him a different perspective.
He hasn't dealt with his trauma. You kick him out. He doesn't even realize he did anything wrong.
Right, right.
And now, where do you think he's going
to
go?
Yeah, straight to the dealer. Yeah. Right? Of course.
Oh, no, let me check another treatment center out. let me go to another sober living. Yeah. That ain't happening.
Not happening, for sure. Especially once you get your feelings hurt.
Right?
Then it's everybody else's fault.
And it's everybody else's fault.
Didn't work.
Right,
I can't do this, you know.
Yeah, I think some of those, you know, Kratom, CBD is another one that I've had to deal with. It's a little weird kind of gray area.
And poppers, it's another one.
I don't know poppers.
You know?
California gets everything first. it'll trickle its way across the country to me eventually.
What is that one called? Is there another word for it?
I don't know. Amyl nitrate, I think.
It's like, it feels like just snorting gas. It just gives you that head rush.
I'm just a drunk. Yeah. I never wanted to snort anything.
I wish I had that.
You wish you had that. Yeah, you wish you had those parameters. Okay, so tell me a little bit about your personal journey and in recovery, and also what led you to do intervention.
God, I got sober in 1989. So in July I'll have 30 years.
Wow.
And when I came to recovery, I didn't want to be sober. You know, I got fired from my job and I was like, unemployment or disability. If I go to treatment, I get disability. So that'll make it longer. You know, the addict mind.
Right, the addict thinking, of course.
So then my unemployment's only good for 16 months, but it won't start if I'm on disability for, you know, as long as I could get that. So I'm like, yeah, I'll do that.
Yeah.
So that's really why I
went
to treatment.
Our best thinking.
Okay. It was going to get longer term of not figuring out, or longer term of unemployment.
Right.
Where I could figure out how to sell drugs better.
Right.
And then I never have to go back to work.
It's good. It's good to find something you're good at. It's where you can really excel.
But I was not good at it. But I wanted to learn to be good at it.
Oh, goodness.
So that's
how it started. What happened in treatment that made you want to continue to stay sober?
Well, I had this, I knew something was wrong, but it was not the drugs. It wasn't the alcohol. And my doctor, you know, at the treatment center was like, we figured it out. They did, you know, blood work. And they were like, I was like 100 pounds less than I am now, 130 pounds at 6 foot. And they were like, we figured it out. And they, you know, they drew my blood because back in 1989, everyone was dropping dead of AIDS.
Right.
So they came back and they said, no, you don't have HIV. You don't have AIDS. But you do have a disease and it's going to kill you faster than HIV or AIDS. And I'm like, oh, my God, what kind of cancer do I have? You know, that's not going to go that quick.
Right.
And I was like, what is it? And he was like, you're a drug addict. And I was like, that ain't a disease.
What that doesn't that? Sound right.
I was thinking you had something new coming out of your pocket, right. You know, something that's rare because I'm special.
Yeah, I'm special. That's right. I need something rare.
The addict mind of
I need
being
something
special.
That I can have some bragging rights
okay.
over.
Hello, I'm dying. You would got to at least tell me something different. And, but when he did say that, something clicked and said, you're going to die if you keep going.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to make it. And so when that thing clicked, then I got where friends were calling me AA squared. Because I was going to a meeting every day.
Right,
I was,
right.
You know, going to movies with people, you know.
Yeah, my friends in my early sobriety, my friends called me super sober.
Super.
They were like, wow, you're like super sober, you know, because I was the same way, meeting every day. I don't think I missed a day for probably my first 5 years. Wow. You know, I was just there. I was
loved
in it.
It
my sponsor
it.
Said, be in it. He said, when you're a part of something, you are an active part. We are not passive members. And I said, right on, let's do it. I had 2 service positions. I was at every business meeting. Like, I was in and I loved it. I had a blast.
When I had 90 days clean, 2 guys asked me to sponsor them. And I was like, sponsor you? I don't even know how to sponsor. I don't even know what I'm doing.
I don't even know what I'm doing, right?
So I went to my sponsor and I was like, these 2 guys asked me to sponsor them. He goes, well, then you do it. If
right.
you have a day more than them. And I was like,
right.
I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah, that's why you have a sponsor. He'll help you.
So that's how AA squared I was. Loved it. Just loved
Yeah, I did
the,
too.
The connection with people and the socializing and... You know, I was always, and we'd go to clubs together because I was young, you know, so yeah. I'd go out dancing and have fun with them and, you know, just having a lot of fun in early sobriety. It wasn't just about going to meetings. We did fun things together. We traveled together. We went to AA conferences all right. over the country together.
Yeah. I always say, because I was the same way, I had a crew of people and we did everything yes. together. We cooked at each other's houses. We had weekly shows we always yep. watched together. We did service work together, which is exactly how I created my sober living houses
yes.
to mimic what my circle was in my beginning. But I always say, like, I was so busy having fun, I forgot that I was getting sober,
yes.
you know, and like I wasn't missing my old life. I wasn't thinking about what I used to do or who I used yeah. to hang out with or whatever. I was just having fun. Yeah, it was great. And there are times I miss that too. And I miss that level of involvement. Of course, my life was much simpler then.
It was much simpler then.
But yeah, it was. It was a good, good time. I loved being that involved.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, I think there's a lot of... you know, talk about how isolative being an addict or an alcoholic who's consumed by the disease of addiction and can't get out, how lonely that is. You know, you hear people right. share all the time. And the antidote to that isn't always medicine. It isn't always treatment. It's really connection.
It's connection. That's
right. And
that right.
connection is what you guys are describing, like, vividly, you know, and it's like that sense of belonging where you finally have that sense of I'm with people who understand me, who know me, who I like, who I can have fun with. And I think that, you know, I think that gets lost in the kind of when we look at how do people recover. I think oftentimes that gets lost, you know, when you hear these people who have 2, 3, 4 years and they go out, they stop going to meetings, they stop right. hanging out with people. And you, what happens when that happens? You feel that same despair, that loneliness, that sense of isolation, I don't belong.
Right.
And that the underlying trauma, the underlying mental health issues, that all exacerbates that. So it's not surprising when someone relapses, even
Absolutely.
Though, oh my God, they have so much time, you know? So I love that's a focus. And that's, again, you know, it doesn't matter if it's 12-step or smart recovery or a chess club or,
That's
you know,
right.
a sports team.
That's the part I feel like people miss.
Yes.
Like, it doesn't have to be any specific thing.
Yes.
It is, I call it feeding my sobriety. Yeah. I have to do things on a daily basis to feed my sobriety.
Yes.
That's how it gets bigger. It gets stronger. Mm-hmm. And then when I have one of those split second moments where my sobriety is threatened for whatever reason,
yeah.
you know, it could be a million things. Maybe somebody hands me a drink at a holiday party. I mean, who knows?
Yes.
But when my sobriety is under attack, so to speak, it has to be strong enough that it can protect me.
Yes.
you know, that yeah. you have to make it strong. You have to feed it, make yeah. it strong.
And that's that motivation. You know, we talk a lot in interventions about, you know, people with a needle in their arm are not motivated to change that behavior. They may want to change that behavior.
Yeah.
They may know they need to change that behavior, but they're not going to say, oh, I found the vein, let me go to Betty Ford, you know,
or yes.
let's come to Ken Seeley's place. You know, that's not going to happen. So there's an external motivation that happens, and that's the whole process of intervention, right? And
yeah.
everybody who goes to treatment has an intervention. It may not be formal, it may not be professional.
Right.
It may be something where they feel that ultimate despair and they turn and say, I need some help. But I think that the key is, how do we maintain, and this is what, you know, we talk about with Be Clear, It's a Year, how do we maintain the external motivation to help someone eventually become internally motivated, like you're talking about,
right.
where it's, I'm going to do anything for my sobriety. I'm going to feed that sobriety so that when someone hands me a drink, I might have that split second thought, but my life today is so good that, okay, I can put that bottle down and then move on with the party.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah. When I was about, I think I was about a year and a half sober, and I was sitting on my couch at home, and I turned on the television, and it was the first time I saw Intervention.
Mm.
And I literally, it was like some kind of force. Like, it came on, and I was watching, and I like moved up to the edge of my couch, and I was like, that is what I am meant to do, without a doubt. Like, I knew, I was like,
that.
That's what I'm supposed to do.
Wow.
It struck so deep in me, those conversations, and managing, and helping, and educating, and coaching, and all of that stuff. I was like, that's it.
Yep.
And my whole focus shifted to, how do I become that?
Mm-hmm.
you know,
love that.
Which was not easy. Certainly, you know, 11, 12 years ago, it wasn't that simple, yeah. Especially being in Kansas, you know, so I'm like Googling, I'm like, is there a credential? And it was the BRI
yes,
then, you know,
yeah,
and, yeah. And okay, so do I need a degree? Because I had never gone to college. I was a yeah. bartender my whole life,
yeah.
even into my sobriety, I continued bartending and I just had no idea what to do, but yeah. that became my sole purpose, was like, okay, these are my steps. Like I figure wow. out what the steps are to get that, to achieve that. And then
amazing.
Yeah, it was incredible.
Right?
It really
amazing.
Was. And I had to, again, people, I was telling you before we started recording, I feel like when I contact people about recording a podcast yeah. in person, they think I'm crazy. So I did the same thing with interventions. Like I literally went on the website and got the list, the AIS website, yes. and had a list of interventionists. And I just started calling people. And I was like, hey, if I pay my own way, can I just sit in the corner when you do
oh,
an intervention?
I love that.
Can I just watch? Yeah. Like, I just want to watch. Because I felt like my whole life, I knew I had a unique ability to connect with people. I've always yeah. had that. So, and I think all helping people mm-hmm. recognize that in themselves, you know? So I felt like I was pretty good on that part and I could do the family dynamics and I could manage that. But you don't really know what that room is going to feel like until you're sitting in it,
yes.
you know?
Yep.
Which is something also that I love about it because it's different every time. It's yep. very challenging, stimulating.
Every time
you're dealing with a different set of circumstances. But in the same way, eerily, it's very much the same.
Mm-hmm.
Because addicts are eerily very yeah. much the same, you yeah. know. But yeah, it was one of my spiritual experiences in my recovery, the show intervention. So thank
wow.
you.
Absolutely. That's interesting, right?
That's cool. Yeah. Usually we get the stories of, oh, I was watching intervention and
all drunk. And I was attracted to it.
Yeah.
But I wasn't as bad as they were.
Yeah, right. Of course.
I hear that one all the time. I wasn't as bad as they were. And I was like, okay.
It's been, I did stop watching it after a while because it was so graphic. And I'm mm-hmm. a little bit of a sissy with some of that
yeah.
stuff. You know, so it kind of started to freak me out. But yeah, it was an incredible journey. And even being a part of that process, even of getting, you know, obtaining the BRI and going to the conferences,
that's
like
amazing.
It was such a thrilling thing wow. for me, and to be around those people, like I wish that community was a little more connected still, you know.
Yeah, a lot better. Nice. Back then.
Yeah,
a lot better.
Yeah. And now I'm a seasoned pro, whoever yes. would have thought.
<That's awesome.
laughs> So what is the status of the television show? Is it, because I thought it left for a while, it came back.
Yep, it stopped for a year. And then it came back a year later because they started playing, I guess this is what happened. They started playing episodes, reruns.
Yeah.
And they were had a high
viewership.
So then they came back the following year and re-signed us up about four or five. How long ago was that? Was it 4 years ago? Mm-hmm. They signed it back up?
Yeah, maybe 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and a new season was just filmed this past year, and I think it's getting ready to air.
Okay.
So
okay.
it'll be airing this. And I like the new format. Did you see the new format?
I haven't seen it, no.
Oh, yeah. They did it last year for the first time. And the new format is really about going into a community and showing, you know, working with the police department, working with the community on
right.
how recovery is available to them. And then intervening on a bunch of people in that one community.
Okay, so one of my interventionist friends in LA reached out to me about this project
yeah.
when it was starting like probably three or four years ago.
Yeah.
And he was telling me that was going to be the format, but I didn't know it was for the intervention show. I thought it was a whole different thing.
No, that must have been something different because they just started that last year. So last year
okay.
was their first year and they did it in
Well,
Atlanta.
I think this was beginning of conversation.
Okay.
It wasn't, they hadn't started filming. It was just the beginning of conversation.
Yeah.
And he just couldn't give me any information because he asked me if I was interested in doing it.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, well, if you give me more information, I'm open to it. But
yeah.
I said, I feel like for me, I always want to be aware of the negativity that can come with stuff like that
mm-hmm.
and make sure that I'm able to
mm-hmm.
to cope with that
yeah.
before I really put myself out there,
yeah.
you know. And he just didn't have very much information, and I don't know whatever happened with it. But that's interesting you're saying that now because
yeah.
that was exactly that conversation I was in several years ago.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I will definitely watch that. That'll be good.
Yeah.
And they're helping more people that way?
Well, it's just given a, you know, because every community has it. You know, I don't care. I'm here in Palm Springs. Hello, we're in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, and a small, what do they say, 40 to 100,000 people in Palm Springs?
Isn't that crazy?
But it's...
But you know, I mean, you guys definitely know from experience, like every single flight I'm on, every restaurant I sit in, if somebody says, what do you do? Everybody has a story.
Every
single person has been personally touched in one way or another, whether it was family, coworker, boss, whatever. But everybody has a story.
Yeah. Everybody's touched by it.
Yeah. This disease is crazy.
And like Eric was saying earlier about, you know, it's about the isolation, you know, when we use, I just, you know, I, when you, before you got here, I just did a trauma group here in our treatment center. And I, in the trauma group, they were talking about, you know, oh, I did Molly to feel connected.
Right.
But that's that false connection.
Yeah.
You know, that craving that we all crave to connect as human beings. It's what we're born into.
Well, and it's all surface level, right? Just like when I was drunk, I always say alcohol, one of the most conniving things about alcohol is it kind of gives you whatever result you're looking for.
Yes.
So if I was tired, I could have a couple drinks and it would wake me up.
Yep.
But if I couldn't sleep, I could have a couple drinks and it would help me sleep. If I was anxious, I could have a couple of drinks and it'll take the edge off. If I'm bored, I can have a couple of drinks and I'll go anywhere to any bar and make friends.
Yes.
And I'm not bored anymore. But it's so surface level.
Yep.
And exactly what you're saying. Then you go home and you feel even more empty
at
the end of the night,
right?
You feel even worse than when you started because you realize how falsely connected your life really is and how surface it is and where are your roots,
and then,
you know?
And then I got to use it as another example. This is my favorite. So then he was like, yeah, but, you know, my girlfriend wants to be back with me now after 2 years. And he's got this big smile on his face. I was like, honey, you got 30 days tomorrow. And you're smiling about your girlfriend coming back in your life. I said, that's another example of that false, you know, connection. You know, you're excited about it. So are you excited about Molly?
Right.
You know, the reality is that until they learn how, until we learn, until we learn how to love ourselves, there's no connection that you're going to make with any human being.
So I was just in this dating conversation at one of my sober living houses yesterday.
Yeah.
And one of the guys was asking, he's like, what is the deal? Like, why do they really say don't date in your first year?
Yeah.
Because, you know, as addicts, we're rebellious by nature. You know, I always say I am much more feral than domesticated.
Yeah.
And if I think that you're trying to tell me what to do, I'm really feral.
Yeah.
So, and I feel like that's in early sobriety, especially, that's how people internalize it. Like you're trying to be the boss of me, you know? And
exactly.
I was like, dude, let me tell you, it's so simple. Your early sobriety. Mm-hmm. I said, the last thing you want is high highs and low lows. We want to be even.
And she's going to bring that, honey.
And nothing will give you higher highs or lower lows than dating.
Yes.
So as I've been sober a long time, I'm still not good at that piece. So just be mindful. That's all I'm saying.
Well, it's funny, you know, for a lot of people, a part of the reason that they turn to drugs is they don't have the coping skills to deal with the feelings. So the women, the men, the food, the gambling, the video games, the phone, they all become ways to either continue numbing ourselves or kind of avoiding having to deal with feelings. And it's like whack-a-mole, you know, that's always
absolutely
what they say.
You know,
you put one thing down, one thing else pops up. And I think that it's so easy on this side of it to say, why would you want a relationship in early recovery with the person you met in detox? I mean, that's like disaster written all over it. But the thing is,
the treatment love affair.
Yeah.
Isn't it romantic?
It's so romantic. And the thing is, though, that the brain is seeking to reward that pleasure center, to reward that behavior in the same way. And when you don't have that reward or that mask, it can be very painful.
Yeah.
You know, it can be very hard to deal with.
For sure.
To look at ourselves and to say, wow, I feel really shitty about myself. And how am I going to change that? Not what am I going to look to that makes me feel better?
Right.
You know, so.
That's so hard for us too.
Oh, totally.
It's so hard
for every human, whether you have an addiction or not.
Yeah.
Know?
We just take it to a new level.
Yeah.
But that is also one of my favorite topics too, are what are some of your other compulsions, right? Because I'm an addicted person. I'm going to be compulsive.
Yes.
Yeah. If I do something and like it, I want to do it more.
Yep. Yes.
So I can have that compulsion with people,
yep,
with my poor dog, for crying out loud. That guy gets all my codependence.
Okay. You know? I love that.
He gets all of it. But I talk pretty openly about food and my struggles, yep, with food.
Yes.
So it comes up in all these different ways that I have to be mindful of, like, what is my intent, yeah, when I'm doing something, you know? And I got locked up in this thing with food where food was pleasure.
Yeah.
And I had to switch that thinking, like, Angela, you feed yourself for nourishment, yeah, not for joy,
yes,
you know? But like, I can do it with shopping and not even so much spending, but I love to just shop because it's numbing.
Yeah.
I can just go and be and look around and, yeah, space off. So I have to be so mindful of my intent,
yep,
of what I'm doing and how I am using or misusing everything.
Yeah. Well, binge watching a series.
Well,
know,
let's not talk about that one.
We're not ready for that.
Oh, is that what a problem? Is that what a problem?
Listen, I have to have some vice, okay? I have to have some vice. Binge watching is it now.
What are you watching that you like?
I don't know. I'm not watching anything right now. You know what I just did is I went back and I watched Oz. Did you ever watch Oz on HBO?
Oh, no.
It's really old.
Yeah, the prison one.
I never got into it before, and I just saw it, you know, online. And I was like, oh, I'll check it out.
Yeah.
And naturally, I watched like all 7 seasons.
In one night.
Yeah, right, in a week. No, it took a little longer
than
that.
Talk about numbing, Eric.
Yes, yes. But I think that's the last thing that I really binge watched. Yeah. Why, what are you watching right now?
Right now, we're not binging anything, but we're pretty faithful for Schitt's Creek. Have you seen
that? Oh, hysterical.
Yes. Isn't that good?
I love that show. Okay, have you watched Grace and Frankie?
Yeah.
I love that
I like
show.
The first couple seasons, and then I'm kind of dropping off.
I just love Jane Fonda. She's, yeah, so freaking funny in that, yeah, show. And her daughter.
Yeah.
One of her daughters. They're so funny. I think the writing's just really smart. But yeah, that's it for me and binge watching.
Yeah.
Okay, tell me, what are some of the things you're seeing in the treatment industry? Like, what are some of the trends you're recognizing right now? And where do you think things are headed in the next 5 years? It's fascinating for me because I've always been really well connected around the country and,
yeah,
not so much in my backyard, right?
Yeah.
Because obviously I don't live in a treatment mecca.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see, to be out here in California and hear a lot of the conversation, mm-hmm, and things that people talk about, because it really is so far ahead of the game. But I don't always get details. So what are you seeing right now?
God, that's a good question. You know, right now I'm seeing, you know, I said this before and I got yelled at, but
I will not yell at you.
Okay. But the reality is, I mean, I'm going to scream it as loud as I can, because treatment doesn't work. I mean, we've been doing, since I got sober in 1989, they had a 3-7% success rate. It's the same success rate.
Right.
3-7%.
Right.
That come in the door. Treatment isn't working. All these new modalities, EMDR and, you know, what are some of the other ones?
CBT.
MI. Oh, blah, blah, blah.
Somatic experiencing.
Yes.
Equine therapy.
Yeah.
Special K, the latest one.
Special K, that's right.
The latest
and you know,
one.
In Florida, they do dolphin therapy,
yeah,
which I personally think would be very beneficial for me.
Dolphin therapy is not ketamine therapy, honey. Yeah, they're a little different.
A little different, yeah, just a tad. Just a tad different.
But all these things that we're doing aren't working.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, and so I get, and then the treatment industry robbed the insurance companies.
For sure.
Overbilling for those urines.
Yep.
Figuring out a way to get more money from them.
Yep.
But then on the other hand, the insurance companies should have known better and not paid it from day one.
That's what I always say. I'm like, who in God's name is sitting at the insurance company approving like a $3,000 UA?
Okay.
Like, who's doing
Shame
that?
On them
who's that
for
guy?
Approving it.
Yeah. No, I absolutely.
But they
agree.
Did.
But
and
they
got ripped off. And
now
so,
everybody's mad.
So that gave them a reason. So I think they approved it to have the reason to stop denying all claims.
Right.
So that gave them permission to stop paying for any claims.
Yeah, yeah.
And then what ended up happening is people had to get loans
right
to cover their cost because now insurance is taking their time.
Yes.
The service is done, but they're not getting paid for 6 months down the road.
Right. Yeah.
And so now how are they going to pay their staff?
I kind of feel bad saying this, but I feel like insurance ruined treatment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I think treatment is a fantastic first step, but it has to be looked at as the first step.
Yep. Well, they dictated treatment.
Yes.
So in the beginning
years of my intervention career, mm-hmm. everybody paid cash for treatment. Mm-hmm. And they found ways to do that, whether it was a home equity loan or a second mortgage yep. or spending the college money yep. or the wedding fund or whatever.
Oh, you've been around a while.
The people figured out a way to pay for it. And I loved that because then they were dictating what kind of treatment they
yes.
got. Then you knew exactly how much time you were getting and what was going to happen in that yep. time. And it was such an easier world in that time. You know, it was so much nicer. But
still back then, the success rate was 3 to 7%.
Still low, for sure.
So,
for sure.
You know, that's why I want to get out there and let everyone know treatment the way it is doesn't work,
yeah.
period. And stop telling me it is working
yeah.
because the only thing growing, and it's not the success,
right.
it's the people dying.
Right.
70,000 people again last year. The last 2 years, over 70,000
people. It's so scary.
It outdid car accidents.
Mm-hmm.
It outdid any other kinds of illness or disease or anything for young adults.
Mm-hmm.
Surpassed everything. So, and we're going to say treatment's working. And these poor, poor families are putting their loved ones in treatment because these kids, because this is their only answer.
Right, right.
But yet they're being put in that circle.
Is the only thing anybody knows to do.
Yes.
Yeah.
So.
I get really frustrated too with treatment centers though when they want to have their own personal success rates.
Oh.
I get really frustrated. Right.
You mean a lie?
And it drives me crazy.
Right.
And I just did a whole episode of Addiction Unlimited about kind of AA myths
yep.
and just saying, listen, here's the deal, dude. We're not weird. We're not doing anything mystical
no.
in those rooms. We're the same idiots that you were drunk with. Now we're just idiots in a different room.
Yeah.
Like, it's that simple. But I also talk about success rates because that's one of the objections you get with Alcoholics Anonymous too,
yes,
is
yeah.
you know, it doesn't work and whatever. And I said, it's like, you have to understand, first of all, you have to dig into how they're doing this research.
Mm-hmm.
Who are they asking?
Yeah.
Who's answering these questions? Because I'm an addict. I'll lie.
Okay.
If you call
addicts
me.
Lie.
Yeah, I know. Newsflash. Addicts lie. So if I go to your treatment center
yeah.
and you call me in a year and say, how are you doing? What the hell do you think I'm going to say?
Yeah.
Fantastic, Ken. Thanks for
yep.
calling. You know?
Yep.
Also, yep. what are they considering long-term sobriety? Because I've dug into some of these studies.
Statistics.
These statistics. And it'll be like 6 months. We consider 6 months long-term sobriety. And I'm like, wait a minute. It's the tip of the iceberg. Like there, so don't
that's stabilization.
Listen. That's stabilization. Barely.
Right?
Barely.
Barely.
Yeah. So don't listen to success rates. They are not accurate for a million reasons. And I just don't feel like it is correct information.
Well, and I think too that the ambiguity stems from a couple things. One, there's not a consistent agreed upon definition of recovery.
Sure.
So a lot of people come strictly from are you abstinent from all mind altering substances? And that is one way to measure recovery, sobriety, success, right? But it's not the only way. There are a whole host of measures, but there's no consistency across
right.
the board with
right.
what people are measuring. One of our initiatives has been to develop a grant to provide free 1 year, 2 times a month urine or breath testing for all clients who come to our treatment center. So we've got a grant writer. He's developing some grants, and the reason for that is because then it becomes an objective third party, and we're not putting a value on it. It's good or bad if the
right.
test is positive or negative. We're putting a value on, we're collecting data, and this is one thing we can measure. But we also have to measure, what are their depressive symptoms? What are their anxiety
for sure.
symptoms? What is their quality of life? How do they think they're doing? What is their hospital readmissions? What is their work productivity? There's all sorts of dimensions, and we as an industry would do well to create some consistency on what we're measuring, create a standard to have someone who's doing that. And then as an industry, if we can say, you know, to an employer, you know, Coca-Cola, let's say, you have substance abuse issues within your company. If you have them participate in this type of a program, they're going to come back and be 40% more productive.
Right.
That's a no-brainer. They're going to do that. We could change the dynamic in the face of kind of what people understand to be recovery and how successful we can be overall.
And then to support appropriately.
Yeah.
You know, which is what I love, coaching in that peer-based support. Like, there's nothing better than peer-based support.
Yeah.
You know, that's the greatest. You have to have it. Yeah. Because you have to, again, it's the connection.
Yeah.
It's all about that connection.
You also have to have accountability. So the reason why I'm on this huge campaign that treatment doesn't work, you know, because it doesn't work. I mean, I don't know what treatment center, like you said, gives these statistics and are lying to the general public because they're all measured differently.
Right.
6 months. Oh, congratulations.
Right.
And 6 months with a phone call. John Southworth, friends of ours, right, that passed,
right. Mm-hmm.
He used to say, oh, I'd be sitting there after my fifth treatment center masturbating, watching Jane Fonda saying, oh, yeah, I'm exercising and, you know,
right.
And he's doing lines of cocaine.
Right.
You know, and that's what he's telling the person on the phone.
Yeah.
That hasn't changed today.
Yeah.
That's the same thing addicts are doing. But the reality is we do know where treatment does work and long-term recovery. We have hard evidence base. Because like Eric said, they're randomly drug tested on a regular basis. So it's the doctors, the nurses, the pilots, the pharmacists. If you have a high license in any profession, they have a thing to protect the public.
Right.
A program to protect the public. It was developed. I have a friend that's over 30 years sober, a doctor that got sober in Florida, and he got sober through this program. And if you're a high licensed professional and you're an addict, they enlist you into this program where the board would say, if you're not going to your meetings and they putting in your card, going to the meeting, if you're not randomly drug testing, if you're not going to do your 90 days of inpatient treatment, if you're not going to do aftercare, meaning therapy, counseling, group counseling, one-on-one counseling, if you're not going to do that for 3 years, and you test positive on one of these tests or don't show up, because if you don't show up, that's a positive.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't do that, we're going to take your license, right?
Right.
That licensing board, they have an 80% success rate.
Right.
So it's proven
that
you need the consequence of your licensing board.
Yeah.
So for the everyday person like you going in and doing an intervention, we create the board of family to be that licensing board to figure out. I mean, every single human being has five things that they would not want to live without. And for high licensed professionals, the number one usually on their list is their licensure.
Mm-hmm.
They work 10 years to get that license.
Right.
They are not going to give it up. And that's why they have an 80% success rate. But every human being has 10 things that they don't want to live with, or five things they don't want to live without.
Yeah.
So as an interventionist, that's what you do when you come in. You create that rock bottom with the family, and now it's the board of family.
Right.
So that's playing in their ear when the trauma gets very difficult in life. They get that, you know, that PTSD flares up, and they say, oh, dealer's house.
Mm-hmm.
They have the board of family saying, you know, I'm going to lose my dog. I'm going to lose my spouse. I'm going to lose my job. You know, if they work at Coca-Cola, you work with Coca-Cola and say, if they don't stay sober, then it's just like a doctor. Fire
them. Right.
Give them one opportunity and then have to let them go. There's enough things that you could find to find the five top things that's going to motivate them to want to stay clean.
So now, as you very well know, sometimes figuring out those consequences, those bottom lines, like this is a really important detail in an intervention, because it doesn't do any good to have bottom lines if you're not going to stick to them.
No.
So I don't mind if a bottom line or a consequence feels like a smaller detail
yep.
as long as you will follow through on it. Like you that's the important part.
Well,
you
have the medical to board through. Isn't going to say, oh, honey, you're trying.
Yeah, right.
Like the families do. Oh, honey, you're trying. We're not going to do this consequence.
Well, you've done so well for the past week.
You smell so good.
And look at you. Did you get a haircut?
Progress, not perfection, right? But you're right. The medical board's not going to say progress, not perfection.
No, they're going to say zero tolerance, boom.
Yeah.
And that's, and I hate to be aggressive that way, but that's the only thing that gets through to the brain of an addict.
For sure.
The brain yes. of the addict is hijacked by the disease.
Yes.
And you're not going to get through to that brain with love.
Yes.
Period. If love would cure this disease, we wouldn't have a disease.
Well, we don't even interpret love correctly. So, no. You know, just like families say, well, we just want him to come to dinner. We just want him to know we love him. I was like, right, that's why he's not coming to dinner. Because that's really overwhelming and uncomfortable. And when I show up yes. to dinner, all I see is how much I've disappointed you and how much pain I've yes. caused and what a failure I am. Yep. And every time you say you love me, I feel like an even bigger failure and a bigger piece of garbage, yep. you know? So... thanks, not coming to dinner.
And that's why it's a family disease. That's yeah. why we got to get the whole family to participate in the recovery process.
For sure.
And that's what we do different is we work with the whole family.
Yeah.
You're not just going to do a family program. I'm tired of hearing about these family programs.
Listen, I'm tired of all of the canned phrases. And
yes.
I have these conversations with all my marketing friends and business development
yes.
and whatever they're calling themselves now. Because they all have different names now. But I always say this. I'm like, I'm not trying to be a jerk.
Yeah.
I just want to be really clear. If you are not even passionate enough about where you work to put it in your own words,
yes.
then I am not the person you want to be talking to.
Yes.
Like, I don't want to hear the canned responses and we do this and we do that. Everybody's doing the same thing. Right.
Wake
treatment's kind of the same yeah. almost
wake
everywhere.
Up my nap.
Yeah. Wake me up for my nap. Right. Because you have, listen, everybody has the same pool of things to draw from to create a treatment center.
Yes.
So if you don't even love what you're doing or where you're working enough to put it in your own words, do mm-hmm. not reach out to me. I don't want to talk about it. Right. I want somebody that can explain it from the inside out and who loves it and is on fire about it. That's the place I'm going to believe in.
And what are you doing different?
What
are you doing
one.
Different? Because all of them are saying they have these high success rates and none of them are working.
Yeah.
So if you could bring me something different, like we always say.
Yeah. Our overdose rate is not dropping, unfortunately.
No, it's going up
yeah.
every year.
And getting younger.
I mean,
heartbreaking.
Kids, it's heartbreaking to see that when the intervention show started in 2005, kids are dying now that... we're born in 2004 and 5.
Right, right.
They're dropping dead from this disease.
Yeah, it's brutal. I wish people understood that too, even families. Like, it's so fun to me when you sit down with a family and you start to kind of break down some of those mm-hmm. barriers and help the family understand that they play a bigger role. Because, you know, everybody wants to point the finger at
yeah.
the addict,
yeah.
right? It's all their fault and all of our family problems are their fault.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, let's look at this for a minute. You know, is there any mental illness floating around in your extended family? Is there any workaholics? You know, when you start to put in, they're like, wow, I never thought of that. I go,
a genogram. Do a genogram
right.
on them, right?
Compulsion's compulsion, my friend. You know, yeah. we can all get out of balance with stuff. So those genetics came from somewhere. It's not all his fault.
Yeah.
And then we look at what is the government doing for this? Like, I love this story because right now, if 70,000 people are dying a day, that's about 200 people or a year, 70,000 a year. That's like 200 people a day. That's like a plane crashing every single day.
Every day.
Right. In the United States alone. We had three planes crash around the world. What was it? The 7 or whatever it was?
Yes.
That was just recently?
Yeah.
Three that crashed around the world, not only in the United States. And everything shut down and they pulled those planes
Everybody's
out.
Everybody's up in arms. Yeah.
Those planes are no longer allowed to fly. But we have one going every day down in this country. And what are we doing about it?
Yeah.
Every day. 200 funerals every day.
It's interesting. I mean, it's just another broken system, but it's like, where do you start, you know? And just like, I think where we focus in sobriety and recovery, mm-hmm. right? Like, I have to focus, I have to be centered yes. to start with and have that self-awareness. And like the same thing I tell my guys in sober living, it's like, listen, you have to make sure you're doing the best job you can do. We can't control people, places, mm-hmm. things, right? We have no control of what anybody else is doing, yes. but be mindful of the impact you're having in the world and yes. be mindful of the effect you have on the people around mm-hmm. you and be the best that you can be. That's where it really starts. Yes. That's where it really starts.
And it's the grassroots. That's yes. the key, is the grassroots is where the answer is going to come from.
Because for sure.
if we could change the whole family systems to change and they put a board of family together, now treatment is going to work because they're motivated to learn what they're teaching in treatment. I'm not saying treatment's a bad thing. I think we need treatment.
Sure.
You got to deal with that trauma. You got to deal with all those things. But if you're sitting there holding your breath and not dealing with those things,
yeah.
because, you know, mom and dad are going to give you back that car after 90 days. You know, you're going to go back to school. You don't need to do this. And really, you know, you're just doing this to appease them.
Right.
So treatment does work when they're hungry and thirsty to learn it.
Yes.
That I love the modalities, the trauma eggs. Judy Crane, I love her.
Totally.
And the work that
love
she does.
Judy Crane. Right? Yeah.
That, I mean, I did some.
I have a great trauma episode of Addiction Unlimited to Yolanda Harper in Florida. And she was a TED speaker.
Oh, really?
And yeah, she does this brilliant piece about trauma because that is a piece also I think is so misunderstood.
Yes.
I talk about this all the time. People do not understand trauma and they don't understand that regular everyday life things are trauma. I feel pretty confident almost everybody in the world has some trauma
yes.
from one thing or another.
Yes.
And
yes.
and we have to kind of pull the curtain back on that stuff too
yep.
and say it's exactly what you're saying. I have to deal with my underlying things. Mm-hmm. I don't feel good,
yes.
which is what drives me to seek a substance
yes.
to feel better. So you have to figure out what that stuff is underneath.
Yep. And,
so
and that's why we need treatment. So we need
right.
treatment. But if you're not going to have them motivated when they walk in their front door, you're going to have a rotating door.
Yes.
They're going to go through the next one to 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 the next one until they hit their rock bottom and feel enough discomfort. And then, oh, that one worked. That's the perfect one. But guess what? Somebody else just went through that one and it didn't work for them. And they're on the rotating bar.
Right.
Circle going to different treatment centers. The reason why that one didn't work, it isn't that that one's better than the one that they started
right, right.
with. It's because they weren't prepared and ready.
Yeah.
But if we could give the families the tools to prepare them and get them ready for treatment, they're going to be like a sponge or a duck in water.
They're going to have a different result.
A,
yeah.
different, a different experience in
yeah.
treatment. Now they're going to dig deep down in. So everybody that leaves our treatment center, they leave with a family contract. So they're not leaving with, oh, great job.
Yeah,
see you
see
later.
Ya.
They have
Good
a
luck.
Family contract that you create when you do an intervention. And they're followed up with the addict 3 times a week. The person, the identified person,
yeah.
and the family member once a week for a year.
Nice.
And we're staying in contact with them, their sponsors, their therapist. We're talking to everybody once a week because, like you said, the addict's going to lie.
Yes.
They're going to.
We can't help it.
No.
I mean, it's not even that we want to do
choice.
It on purpose. It's
yeah.
just. It's just how we're wired.
Yes.
You know, especially in active addiction, early sobriety. That's just how it is.
Yes.
It's just how it is. We don't mean to.
No, we don't. And we
it's
don't,
not personal.
But, yeah. And a lot of families take it personal.
Yeah, they do. Just, they do.
They should, but it's, you know, it's kind of that instinctual behavior that's being overridden, all of that decision-making stuff that most people have been able to implement and put in their lives.
Well, there also was, it was absolutely imperative to my survival.
Yes. Yeah.
To be able to lie and manipulate was imperative to my
yes.
survival.
Yep.
That doesn't just get thrown out the window.
No.
You know, just because I finally put the tequila down doesn't mean I'm magically better. It's been a
yeah.
full-time job. I am a full-time job.
Yes. And it's the rest of our life. Like, I
yeah.
loved when, you know, John passed away over a year
yeah.
ago. And he was 79 years old. And that year, he was doing trauma workshops with Judy Crane.
Nice.
And crying about that little boy that was
yeah.
mistreated.
Yeah.
And working a program of recovery. So
he had such a major impact on my career, too. you know, for whatever reason, I met John, we just hit it off, and he was such an incredible...
Well, I can tell why. Look how beautiful you are.
The listeners don't know that. They don't know that he was like that. But he said something to me really early on, because early on, I had a ton of interventions, right? Yeah. Like, I was crazy. I was flying all over the country every week doing interventions. Yeah. And he said, Angela, you have to diversify. He said, never put all your eggs in one basket. Mm-hmm. You have to be doing other things and make sure they're things you enjoy.
Love it.
I loved it, right? It made such a great piece of advice, you know? And the other thing that Southworth did is every time he hung up the phone with you, he told you he loved you.
Yeah.
Every time.
Every time. And when I first... when I first met him, right, the first couple times I talked to him and he'd hang up, he'd go, okay, love you, buddy, thanks, and hang up. And I'd be like, huh, okay. And then I grew to just love that. And you hear him do it with everybody. And I was like, God, it's so endearing. And it's so
kind.
So he
did it with everyone? I thought it was only me.
Most of the time it was just you. Okay, last
question. And he even helped me. And I'm not good looking. So he helped everyone.
He did help everyone. Okay, last question, favorite question.
Okay.
What is your favorite thing about being a sober person? Both of you.
I think it is my dreams become a reality. And I dream bigger and bigger every year, and they still become a reality.
Yeah.
I don't understand it. I don't know how I get there, but they become a reality.
Yeah.
So
it's so good.
Isn't that amazing?
It's a good life. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd say my favorite thing is also the most challenging thing for me, and that is being present. And I think that I realized how not present I was when I was using, like completely checked out on every emotional level. And to be able to recapture that and to have authentic relationships and to do things that authentically make me feel good is really wonderful. And on the other hand, it's really challenging to maintain that. It's really hard. You know, I suffer from anxiety, and being present can be overwhelming at times.
Yeah.
And no matter how much sobriety I get, I feel overwhelmed a lot of the times. But the nice thing is I know I don't have to use to be able to make it through. And that's really the gift of recovery, is being able to be present and being able to know that, you know, this too shall pass.
Yes. Yeah. And it is crazy to think about my lack of just basic awareness of everything around me, right? Yeah. When I was drunk, like I had zero awareness. Nice. The things that I recognize now, the things that today I have gratitude for every day of my life are things that I wasn't even aware of when I was drinking. Yeah.
Yep.
It's beautiful. Yeah. You guys, thank you so much for doing this with me. It has been so fun. Maybe we'll get to do a follow-up at some point too, because I told you I'm going to start having people back on. So thank you again. To you guys, listeners, all of the contact information and Ken Seeley Community's information, all of that stuff will be in the show notes. You can access that there. And I hope you guys are having a great, great day, and we'll see you next week.
You've reached the end of another great episode of the Addiction Unlimited podcast. Candid and honest conversation about addiction and recovery. Be sure to visit us at addictionunlimited.com to join the conversation and access show notes and links to everything we talked about. Love this episode? Please take 30 seconds to subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes to help us improve and give you the information you want. Thanks for listening. See you next week.